We are talking today with Victor Navasky. Victor Navasky is publisher emeritus of The Nation. He was the magazine's editor from 1978 to 1995 and publisher and editorial director from 1995 to 2005. He is currently the Delacorte Professor of Journalism at Columbia University. Before coming to The Nation, he was an editor at the New York Times Magazine and wrote a monthly column about the publishing business called In Cold Print for the New York Times Book Review. Victor Navasky has also served as a Guggenheim Fellow, a visiting scholar at the Russell Sage Foundation, and Ferris Visiting Professor of Journalism at Princeton. He is the author of several books, including Naming Names, which won the National Book Award in 1982, the book Kennedy Justice, and his latest book, A Matter of Opinion. Victor Navasky, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Good to be here.
Let's begin and tell us, what was the motivation in writing your current book, A Matter of Opinion?
Well, you know, I sort of, because I am a book writer as well as a writer, I always feel naked if I'm not working on a book. And when I came to The Nation, it seemed to me that no one had ever written a book about journalists of opinion before, and that it's the one thing I could do without having to go and do the kind of research that I normally feel I have to do when I did Naming Names, a book about the Hollywood blacklist, or Kennedy Justice, about Robert Kennedy's attorney generalship. It was a lot of reporting involved. So I thought I could do a sort of meditation on the role of these magazines, asking whether they were relics of the 18th century or a counterforce to all the terrible things that are happening in journalism today, you know, the homogenization, conglomeratization, Murdochization, Oprahfication, and all of that stuff. Well, it turned out that I was wrong on two counts. Number one, someone had written a book about these journals before. The Frankfurt philosopher Jürgen Habermas, who is known for his theories about the public sphere, wrote a book, the first half of which is the history of the Journal of Opinion, and the second half, his notion of the public sphere. And he sort of traces the origin of these journals back to the period of coffee houses and taverns, when people would sit around and talk about what was happening in the courts. And by the court, I mean the royal court, not the legal court. And these taverns started their own newsletters, and then the newsletters began by accounting the travel of the nobles back and forth, and then they started criticizing the people they were writing about, and so you got journals like The Spectator and The Tatler and Daniel Defoe's The Review. It's a fascinating thing, and the reason no one knew about it was, aside from the fact that, you know, it's written in the impenetrable prose of the Frankfurt School, it wasn't translated into English for 25 years. And then finally, when it was, it came out under the catchy title of The Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere, a Category of Bourgeois Society. So that was one thing I was wrong about. And the second thing I was wrong about was that I could write it while editing The Nation. It turned out that there's more than enough, or at least for me, to do as I running the magazine every week, and it was very hard to get around to it. So when I finally took a sabbatical after 16 years as editor for the magazine and sat down to write it, in the middle of my sabbatical, I got a call from my publisher, who made me an offer I should have refused and sold me the magazine for money I didn't have. And I had to go out and raise a lot of money. And at that point, I changed my idea for the book from a third-person meditation to a sort of first-person misadventure story. And when I finally finished a draft, I showed it to my son. And this is a very long answer to your short question, but when I finally finished a draft, I showed it to my son, and he read all the three pages, and he said, "Oh, I get it. It's a how not to." So that's how I came to write this, A Matter of Opinion.
What did you come up with in terms of opinion publications like The Nation?
Well, you know, in my view, they, at a time when journalism is in real trouble, both in the newspaper world, where they're cutting back on bureaus, and television, where they're cutting back on bureaus around the world, where because of the new media, which shows great promise to do certain kinds of things, but one result of it is that it's speeded up the news cycle and increased this trend towards soundbite journalism, and what the late Neil Postman called the Las Vegasization of the news, the in his book Amusing Ourselves to Death. These journals are the place that where you can really get serious political discourse and extended argument and the mobilization of facts to support a point of view. And, you know, I mentioned Habermas before. I actually went and visited him in Frankfurt, and it's like making the pilgrimage to the great man, and it took a lot of doing to get an appointment, I have to tell you. But when I finally got to see him, we had a great talk for about an hour and a half, and at the end I asked him what I thought was a $64,000 question, which is a version of what you just asked me, Mike, which was, you know, what is the role of these journals in this age of electronic conglomerated journalism? And he said, the answer is very simple. And to you, it may sound, and your listeners, it may sound like a cliche, but to me, who had been thinking about this for 20, 25 years, it had all the clarity of the Liberty Bell. He said, it is to set the standard for public discourse. Well, to set the standard, well, that's a pretty noble role for a type of journalism. And that's what these magazines at their best do.
Do you think the level of discourse has dropped since you started at The Nation?
Well, I wouldn't. You mean because I started?
No.
I wouldn't. I don't know. It's been in trouble for a long, long time. And what's interesting is there's a guy named Jeff Scheuer who wrote a book called The Soundbite Society, where he makes an argument, which I don't agree with, by the way, but it's a very interesting argument. He argues that the reason the right wing is so successful on television, among other things, and the left is not, is that the right wing message is reducible to sound bites. And the left wing message is much more complicated, and it doesn't work in that kind of medium of entertainment. And it is certainly true in recent times that television replaced newspapers as the source of news for a lot of people, and the new media now are or aren't replacing television. We don't know that yet. I have one bit of what to me is interesting news to report, which is that at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, where, as you mentioned, I teach, they have four areas of concentration for their graduate students who are getting their master's in journalism. One is print, which by which they mean newspapers. The second is broadcasting, television and radio. The third is new media, and the fourth is magazines. For the last 3 years, magazines have been the number one choice of students. So one has to ask why, and we don't know. There hasn't been a scientific survey. I suspect it has at least partly to do with the theory that they'll get more help in their desire to become good writers by taking the magazine major. But that's because you're dealing with long-form journalism, and that requires a kind of rigorous mental discipline to deal with ideas, to organize your thoughts, to shape the article. And that, to me, is a hopeful sign.
Because I've heard from people, I believe, like Robert McChesney has said that the attendance at journalism schools has been declining, and, for instance, like PR has been, you know, replacing that.
Well, Bob McChesney is an invaluable student of everything that's happening in journalism and a great scholar and the leading authority on the invidious effects of conglomeratization. And, you know, it is without doubt true that more and more fewer and fewer companies can dominate more and more of the media and information environment, and Bob McChesney has demonstrated that to a fairly well. He also is correct about the trend in journalism schools writ large, that most of them now teach public relations. They also teach advertising and business. The Columbia Graduate School of Journalism and the Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism do not. They are both graduate schools. The other programs are undergraduate programs, sometimes with a graduate component. Both at Columbia and Berkeley, they're strictly graduate institutions. To them, it's church-state. You don't deal with PR. The way I put it, there was a great book called Life in the Crystal Palace that came out in the 50s by a former PR guy named Alan Harrington. And he said, you know, at the heart of every profession, there is a value. The value at the heart of law is justice. The value at the heart of medicine is healing. And the value at the heart of journalism is truth. The value at the heart of PR is the distortion of truth in favor of your client. So, no, they don't teach that at Columbia or at Berkeley. I think whatever the trends writ large are, at Columbia they've just started a second master's program, Master of Arts in Journalism, as well as the Master of Science, which they now give. So the trend is the reverse. There's more and more interest in what's happening and more applicants. And I don't think Columbia's alone in that. I think they've tapped into something that younger people are looking for.
Do you think that hunger that younger people pursuing that choice of careers now is due to them seeing the wasteland of what was once media?
Well, I'm not a big one for making great social pronouncements. I'm of an age where I remember that I confidently predicted Adlai Stevenson would be president of the United States, so I don't take what I have to say in that arena all that seriously. But it is my impression that the most engaged, and which I take to be the most serious, which I take to be ultimately the most influential of the upcoming generation, not in an elitist sense, but in an socially responsible sense, an politically active sense, a caring sense. Yeah, that those folks don't get sufficient satisfaction from media the way it is now, or from the educational process in journalism the way it is in all these other places. Now, I have to say, I'm not one of those folks who believes you have to go to journalism school to be a great journalist. I never went to one myself, and you know, if people ask, I really say it depends on you. You might do better if you to get more training in economics or politics or the arts, or get a job for a few years and then see. On the other hand, it can be a very valuable experience in honing your craft and in sharpening your ability to analyze problems and your critical faculties. And the way things are now in the world of media, you don't get mentoring on the job the way you used to, and you do get it in a decent academic institution.
Is that why you chose to teach at Columbia?
Well, I don't know. I've taught all my life while doing other things. I taught, you mentioned, at Princeton. I taught it. The way I made my living as a freelance writer was I'd get a book idea, and then I would write articles related to it, and I'd try to find teaching assignments related to it. So I'd teach myself at the same time I taught students. So when I was working on the Hollywood Blacklist book, Naming Names, I taught a course on propaganda at NYU. I taught a course on cooperative witnesses, the informers at Wesleyan during the 60s when they had these short courses. And so I've always sort of taught on the side. And when I came to the Nation, it's a way of staying in touch with young people and imparting what little you have to impart. So I started teaching at Columbia, and they asked if I would do it, and I was happy to be asked and agreed to do it. And I started it in a part-time way, and as I sort of have virtually graduated from the Nation, although I seem to go to the office every day, so I don't know what it means to be emeritus yet, I've become the Delacorte Professor of Magazines up there, and I run their magazine program. And I also chair the Columbia Journalism Review, which is a great new responsibility that I'm looking forward to.
And what's involved with that?
Well, you know, CJR, the Columbia Journalism Review, is the sort of premier monitor of journalism in the United States, and it's supposed to be an impartial monitor of what's happening in the profession. And when it became known that I was coming, they got an outraged letter from one of their subscribers who canceled his subscription on the grounds that having the former editor of The Nation preside over CJR was like inviting Bill Buckley to do it from the right, and that's not what they were set up to do. And the executive editor said, "What do I say to this?" So I said, "Well, you say nothing. Let me respond to this." So what I said in my editor's reply, or chairman's reply, I said, "Look, the question, can the former editor and publisher of The Nation be a... preside over the Columbia Journalism Review, it's a good, interesting question." And I said, "I haven't checked the letters to the editor section to see whether the writer wrote a similar letter when the editor of Fortune, the former editor of Fortune, was named the chairman of the Columbia Journalism Review, or the editor-in-chief, or when the former editor of U.S. News and World Report was named the editor-in-chief of the Columbia Journalism Review." I said, "I hope he didn't, or he maybe did, but that they both ran very distinguished magazines, and only time will tell the answer to his question. But, you know, if you're in the business of maintaining standards, and if you're in the business of attempting to monitor the integrity of the media, and if you're in the business of trying to recognize good journalism, and if you're in the business of judging the quality and logic of arguments, moral, political, and cultural, in the world of print and other media, politics doesn't determine ultimately the way you see things. It may help shape what you think is important and what you cover. But again, let's see what happens."
How would you define good journalism?
Well, I feel like Eisenhower, and, you know, when he said, "You know it when you see it," it's getting as close to the truth as it's possible to get. And it's being open about, in the case of opinion journalism, it's being open about your own political values, but it's also making those three extra phone calls to make sure you got it right. And what it's not is what they used to teach at journalism school, which is a formula of the inverted pyramid. It's not pseudo-objectivity, where you give the appearance of objectivity by quoting people on two sides of an issue that may only have one side, the Holocaust, or may have 27 sides. How do you get out of Iraq? What should you do now? So I don't have the neat definition.
So how do you wrestle with that whole notion of objectivity with, for instance, your students?
I like to quote Molly Ivins on objectivity, because who I cite on page 409 of Matter of Opinion. And let me just read you what she said, because she said it better than most people, I think. Here's what she says. "The fact is that I am a 49-year-old white female college-educated Texan," she said. "All of that affects the way I see the world. There is no way in hell that I'm going to see anything the same way that a 15-year-old black high school dropout does. We all see the world from where we stand. Anybody who's ever interviewed five eyewitnesses to an automobile accident knows there's no such thing as objectivity." Now, having said that, that doesn't mean that you don't try to get it right. That doesn't mean that you don't try to be accurate. That doesn't mean that there's no such thing as reliable information, and that you help the reader distinguish between reliable and unreliable information. But you shouldn't fool yourself into thinking that by talking to, saying what he said and what she said and reporting them, that you've given the reader the objective view of what happened.
What do you think the real strength of The Nation magazine is?
Well, you know, The Nation, in the magazine business, survival is the ultimate test of success. And The Nation was founded the year the Civil War ended, and it is America's oldest weekly magazine. And the reason I believe it survived all these years is partly, and ironically, that it has been more a cause than a business, and that people cared more about its mission than its bottom line. And this is not true just about The Nation, by the way. The editor of National Review now, Rich Lowry, I had him come speak to my class. We have differences of opinion, but as he said, we're both publishing magazines whose job is to make a point, not a profit. And having said that, I can sum up what The Nation means to me in two sentences. One is the first sentence that appeared in the first issue on the first page, or the first paragraph, the first story of the first Nation on July 6, 1865. Here's the sentence. The week was singularly barren of exciting events. Now consider that as the opening sentence of a new magazine. I mean, that's a very courageous sentence, because what it says is, we're not going to play the game of false hype. We're not going to sensationalize the news. We're going to tell the truth, boring though it may be, or wherever it leads. And that's a noble principle. The second sentence, however, that speaks to me in the terms of The Nation's heritage and why I think it at its best defines where we are today, is taken from another magazine, The Liberator, which was an abolitionist magazine published by a great abolitionist, William Lloyd Garrison, which went out of business when the Civil War was over and turned over its subscription list to The Nation because they had achieved their goal of abolition. And The Nation, by the way, part of its original franchise was to cover the plight of the newly freed slaves. But here's the sentence that Garrison was known for. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will not retreat a single inch. And what that says is, yes, we're not going to play the game of false hype and all that, but we are going to fight on behalf of the dispossessed. We're going to fight, we're going to crusade on behalf of what we believe to be social justice and equal rights and all of the rest of the program. And you put those two themes, those two sentiments together, and at its best, that's what The Nation magazine is for me.
All right. And do you try and instill some of those same values with your students?
Well, I do not try to inflict my politics on my students. But sure, you try to connect them to, you know, your first question was, what is good journalism to you? To examples of great journalism, of great investigative reporting, Lincoln Steffens, Ida Tarbell, the muckrakers at the turn of the century. In The Nation's case, Fred Cook, who wrote the first exposés of the FBI and the CIA at the time when those were sacred cow institutions and you couldn't touch them. And you're tough in grading their papers. I don't mean grading them A, B, C, D, E, but I mean in responding to what they turn in and helping them make it better. And I teach a workshop on a magazine production workshop, and the students produce a magazine every year. We call it the New York Review of Magazines, and they write it, they edit it, they fact check it, they copy edit it, they proofread it, they help design it. But they'll go through 6, 7, 8 drafts of a body piece, and you know, my job is not to edit it for them, but it is to make sure that everything is of professional publishable quality, and to keep getting them to do the best they can and pointing out the limitations of the last draft.
What are your thoughts on the current climate with the reporters who are being challenged legally for instance, not being forthcoming with the information about the people they're interviewing, where they got their sources, things yeah. like that?
Well, I think there are two very separate issues. Number one is there is a degradation internally in the journalistic process in the sense of, well, take the famous book by this fellow, Jim Fry or Frey, whatever his name was, where he turned out to make up stuff about his own life. You don't do that. The overuse of anonymous sources, which makes it impossible for the reader to evaluate the information and for even specialists in the field to know whether to trust what the writer has said. Those are distressing aspects of contemporary journalistic culture, and there are all kinds of ways to And that's why I think Columbia Journalism Review and a magazine like The Nation, and in its own way, National Review, I guess, they're very important to have these independent media monitors out there checking on what's being said. And then you listen to them, and you, in the Habermas would say, you know, the ultimate authority is the better argument. So you pay attention, you listen, you weigh, and then you make your judgment. And the more voices there are to do that, the better. That's internal to the journalistic process. Externally, you have this specter of the state, in this case, the Bush administration, persecuting and prosecuting journalists for doing their job, essentially. And in the case of Judy Miller at the Times, who, in my view, did a very poor job in covering the issues of weapons of mass destruction and didn't exercise the judgment you're supposed to exercise in deciding, or didn't exercise it well. She may have exercised it, which sources you trust, and then her editors exercised poorer judgment in putting her stories on the front page, and the administration seized on those stories, which they may have given birth to in the first place as anonymous sources to prove. Even the New York Times, you know, says that they're weapons of mass destruction and that Saddam Hussein is attempting to develop a nuclear capacity. That the government, in going after the press in that way, is assaulting the thing that distinguishes us from the so-called enemies of democracy. But it's not just the legal assault on the press. It's the political assault on the press, the attempt to intimidate critics of the Iraq War from even before it began. But once it was underway, to suggest that people like Susan Sontag, who wrote something in the New Yorker, or others who questioned the wisdom of the war, were unpatriotic or treasonous or somehow undermining the democratic project by pointing out or arguing the injustice or the impracticality or the failure to disclose fully what was going on in connection to the war in Iraq. That, it seemed to me, is a misguided and at worst a cynical and even corrupt enterprise if you try under the guise of national security to suppress not only free speech, but in this case, legitimate criticism, the suppression of which helps result in the loss of lives, Iraqi and American alike. And then there's been a cutback on information across the board by the current administration through the way in which they manipulate the Freedom of Information Act, which was intended to open information, governmental information, to the citizenry. They use it to block access to information. And across the board, they have reclassified material that was open to the public previously. And this is a time when the alarm has to be sounded on behalf of the free flow of information and free speech and First Amendment values.
So are you concerned or hopeful at this point in terms of...
Well, I am, but, you know, the late I.F. Stone, who always described himself as a Jeffersonian Marxist, used to say he was also an optimist, that things seem to have a way of coming around. And I guess that is ultimately the premise of the people like myself who believe in free speech, and it goes all the way back to John Milton's Areopagitica, however one says it, and John Stuart Mill, that good speech will drive bad speech out of business ultimately. So in the longest of runs, yes, I'm optimistic. Now that's if we don't blow ourselves up in the short run. And given the problems of nuclear proliferation, I don't underestimate the possibility of that.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. Any final thoughts you would like to share?
No, this is good. I'm very pleased to be here to have this conversation with you, Mike.
Thank you. We have just been talking with Victor Novasky, publisher emeritus at The Nation and author of the new book, A Matter of Opinion, a winner of the 2005 George Polk Book Award.